Warning to listeners, this conversation is about mental health and will include some discussion of mental illness and suicide. The U.S. Surgeon General released a report last week warning about a crisis in youth mental health. In 2019, a third of high school students reported persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness, according to the report. That's a jump of 40% from 10 years earlier. And the pandemic has brought new stresses with transitions to and from remote learning, coupled with the uncertainty surrounding COVID-19. We're taking a closer look now at the factors driving this crisis in youth mental health and what parents, caregivers, and loved ones need to know. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a young person struggling with mental health concerns yourself, or are you seeing that among your friends? Have you noticed stress and anxiety rising in young people in your family or community? What effects have you seen the pandemic have on mental health for young people in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Anna Moffitt is Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, Dane County. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
And Dr. Ryan Herring is a professor and director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He directs the BRAVE Research Center, which studies the brain's role in resilience and vulnerability among youth following traumatic events. Dr. Herring, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, Dr. Herring, a big picture, we heard this warning call, really, from the Surgeon General here. What kind of things are we seeing in the run-up to the pandemic and since the pandemic started when it comes to trends in youth mental health?
Yeah, as you pointed out in the intro, there were already significant increases in youth mental health problems, even before the pandemic, such as increases in depression, anxiety, even suicide rates. And unfortunately, the pandemic has really exacerbated all of those things. So we're continuing to see even further increases in anxiety and depression, suicide as well, particularly in girls, increases in emergency department visits. And there's really just a tremendous need for mental health services for youth. So there's a lot of stressful factors, not just the pandemic, but other factors, racism and discrimination, that are really taking a toll on some of our most vulnerable youth.
Anna, can you talk some more about the stresses you're hearing about from young people over this last couple of years?
Sure. Well, you know, I think one of the biggest stressors is going from being in all remote learning right back into full-time in-person learning. I know it's important for people to stay connected and be in person, but I think it's been a tough transition for our youth to go through such a traumatic time and not really have a space to process that before they're kind of being put back with the same expectations of 2 years prior and not really taking into account the toll the pandemic has taken on their mental health.
Dr. Herring, some people point towards social media is, if not the cause, then an accelerant of these mental health concerns. What role do you see social media playing in this?
I think that's a really good point. The way it's accelerated and catalyzed a lot of the mental health problems for youth is really problematic, and it's being increasingly recognized that it's contributing to anxiety. The recent reports about Instagram contributing to eating disordered behavior and distortions in body image in girls. There's a lot of concern to be had around social media use. I will point out that, and many teens will tell you this too, social media does also have its advantages. So it has been a way for youth to stay connected during the pandemic, particularly when they were in lockdown at home. So I don't want to categorize it as an all bad thing. I think it's really, it's a technology and it's how it's used. So I think having that conversation and making youth and families aware of that is important.
Anna, can you talk about the role of uncertainty during the pandemic? It's one thing to have an immediate traumatic event, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but just sort of the ongoing uncertainty about the future. How is that affecting kids?
It does have a negative impact on kids. Especially, it has a negative impact on everybody. As human beings, we do cherish our routines, and that is something that helps keep our mental wellness and stability. So having, you know, these disruptions time and time again can be really destabilizing for kids and adults. And so we do see that. And, you know, I think there's layers of uncertainty, and depending on demographic groups, you're going to see certain demographic groups facing far more uncertainties and instability than other groups. And so really being intentional about where we're putting our support as far as mental health supports, and making sure we are supporting those that are going to have the greatest level of need.
We're talking about youth and mental health after a Surgeon General alert that there is a crisis in mental health among young people in this country. Anna Moffitt is with us from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, Dane County, and Dr. Ryan Herringa from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Donna is with us in Brookfield. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. There's no doubt that the pandemic has caused a lot of havoc among our teens. My question is that historically, kids have gone through other periods of tough times. For instance, kids who survived the Holocaust, or kids who have survived civil wars in their country, or horrible things like that. Is there data comparing those kind of historical events to what's happening now? And if our kids aren't faring as well, why might that be, and what can be done?
Donna, thanks for the call. I'll throw that one to you, Dr. Herringa.
That's a really great question, Donna. I don't know if we have all the answers. In fact, I'm sure we don't have all the answers on that yet. I'm not aware of research directly comparing the two and outcomes. And of course, there's so many different factors, the historical era, the people were in, the different countries, cultures involved. I do think maybe one thing you're hinting at is that kids are also capable of a great degree of resilience. And if we can build those structures and supports around them, and like Anna was talking about earlier, give support to particularly those families who are particularly in need, I think that can go a long way. And another aspect of this is to what degree the family life and family structure has been disrupted. We talk about the problems of youth mental illness, but this is really COVID in particular has had effects on the entire family and on communities. And I think if we can really support caregivers, parents, and communities, that will have a tremendous impact on teens, on children, for helping them to not only survive and cope, but ideally even to come through this with resilience and even stronger.
Thanks for that call, Donna, at 800-642-1234. Anna, on that issue of support, I wanted to ask, I assume there are maybe resources we don't have, but what kind of resources are there for people who, a young person experiencing a mental health concern, or their family members to reach out to?
Well, I would certainly encourage folks to reach out to a local NAMI affiliate or NAMI Wisconsin. We have affiliates all across the state. So I think our organization is a great starting point to help families and kids get connected with more local resources. And of course, if you have somebody struggling in crisis, using crisis lines, using or texting 741 and text, use a text crisis line. So just reaching out. There's a lot of variability across the state as far as services and supports. And we know within our rural areas, it's a big problem. But with that being said, there are supports out there. So I would really get familiar with what's in your community locally. I really encourage children and youth and family members and caregivers to be proactive. Even if nobody is struggling with a mental health condition at this point in time, find out what's available, because things can change quite rapidly. And it's good to be proactive and be prepared.
We're talking to Anna Moffitt with NAMI Dane County and Dr. Ryan Herringa, expert in youth psychiatry at UW-Madison. With us today to talk about a new report from the U.S. Surgeon General about a crisis in youth mental health, a crisis that started pre-pandemic, according to a lot of the data out there. The pandemic, of course, not helping matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's tough to talk about mental health in your family or your community? Have you found a good way to talk about it in your own family? Do you have a local resource you would point toward as something that helped maybe you or someone you know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about youth mental health. Anna Moffitt from NAMI Dane County stays with us, along with Dr. Ryan Herringa from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. We've got Jacob with us in Chippewa Falls. Jacob, hi. Are you there, Jacob? I think we've lost Jacob, but thanks for giving it a shot. Well, Dr. Herring, I know you focus in your work in part on young people have been through a trauma of some sort, a traumatic situation, and trying to help build resilience. What kind of things do help foster that kind of resilience you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, there are a number of things that I think can help youth and families to help kids thrive and to get through really stressful and traumatic situations. Certainly one of the biggest factors is social support and making sure that youth have an opportunity to be in a supportive school, that the family has the resources they need. That may mean addressing things like housing and food insecurity and even and financial insecurity as well, which Congress certainly tried to do, at least at some level. There are also, I think, other factors such as peer support groups. Anna talked a lot too about, or NAMI is an incredible organization with a lot of supports and guidance available. But really reaching out to sort of the natural supports that youth and families may have. Maybe that's a religious organization the family belongs to. You know, maybe it's a neighborhood community center. It could be a coach or a teacher, a school counselor. So I think really it's important to bring in those supports, and also for families to really have those conversations to the extent that they can, to check in with each other and see how everybody's doing. And the last thing I'll add is for caregivers, for families, to really not hesitate to get support for yourselves. It's caregiving, parenting is an incredibly hard job and has become so much harder during the pandemic. And so I'm hoping for parents, for caregivers, that the bar would be lowered to get themselves some help as well, to bring some compassion and being open to getting that help and guidance. We all need it.
And I wanted to ask about the role of peers in particular for that, say, a high school student who's worried about a friend based on in-person interaction or what they're seeing in social media. What kind of things can peers think about and be aware of to at least try to help?
I think peers are such an important piece, especially when we're talking about adolescents. And so really, you know, if you have a friend who you think may be struggling based on stuff that you're seeing in social media or behaviors or conversations, is to really not be afraid to be upfront and just acknowledge what you're noticing about maybe their behaviors, their thoughts, or their feelings, and to let them know that you're concerned and that you want to help and that you will be there for them. I think just being open and honest and having that conversation. You know, I would also, too, as far as peers, you know, if you have a friend and they disclose something like thinking about or planning to take their life, that would be a conversation that you would most definitely have to pass on to a trusted adult. And so it's important for peers to support each other, but it's also important to reach out to a trusted adult if you have significant concerns for your friend.
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Jacob back at Chippewa Falls. Jacob, I'm sorry. I think that was on our end, but I think we have you now. Hi, Jacob.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
So I'm just wondering when the cost of mental health starts to outweigh the cost of COVID. As far as I understand, currently the death rate of COVID is still less than 1%. And I don't know what the statistics are for suicide and you know, significant mental health costs or costs associated with mental health. But I'm wondering, at what point do we say, hey, the cost of mental health and the issues that are being caused by COVID, and not that mental health is only caused by COVID, but I'm wondering, how has it changed since the pandemic? And at what point do we, as a public health official, say, here, now this is a much bigger issue that we're causing or that we're intensifying compared to the risks associated with this pandemic that we're still apparently in?
Jacob, thanks for the call. Dr. Herring, it can be tough with 800,000 deaths. Those all have a mental health impact potentially on young people as well. How do you try to balance out mental health impacts of COVID measures versus the public health measures that we need?
Yeah, Jacob brings up a really good point that it's a tough balance to strike, right? The scale on which COVID is acting and the number of people dying, you know, takes obviously a tremendous toll on families. And, you know, for many youth, they've lost a caregiver or, you know, loved family member or a friend. And that's really, really hard for one's mental health. I think one area we've seen this really change this year in terms of really striking a balance between trying to mitigate and at least slow down the spread of COVID and protecting youth mental health is in the schools. And most schools are now operating back in person if they had been closed. And that's really based on increasing evidence that school closures and remote learning are really not good for kids. They're not good generally for kids' education. And we're finding out it's not good for kids' mental health to be remote and not interacting with peers in person. Certainly there are special cases for children who may have vulnerable immune systems or special learning needs where, you know, where different situations apply. But I think that's a really good example of where public health has struck a balance between trying to keep kids at school when at all possible, while certainly doing everything else that they can, including distancing and masking, to try to minimize the spread of COVID.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Anna, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line talking about the cost of mental health care in some cases. It's easy to say, seek some kind of professional help. How are we doing when it comes to A, access to that kind of help, and B, the affordability of help people might need?
Well, that's a great question. And honestly, as far as access, I would argue that we're not doing a very good job. I mean, especially when we're looking at children and youth, only about 50% of children and youth with a diagnosis actually are accessing treatment. So that, you know, means one in two people aren't getting treatment. So we really need to explore why that's happening. Of course, cost, access to healthcare is a barrier for a lot of families, as well as wait times for getting services. So I think it's something that needs to be addressed more by, and I would even say by government levels, because we're talking about bigger systems. It's not an issue that can, you know, be resolved by different small groups working on it. It really is like a systemic issue that needs to be addressed. But yeah, I mean, I the numbers don't bear out well. And even looking at when someone is diagnosed, it's usually about 10 years until they're in treatment. And so really figuring out why that's happening, because we know the earlier we intervene and provide treatment, the greater outcomes, the better recovery journey that people will have, especially our children and youth.
Dr. Herring, looking to the future, are there things that make you hopeful that we can deal with this trend, this problem of youth mental health concerns, again, that started before the pandemic? Any bright spots that you see out there?
I do see some positive trends. I think the increasing emphasis and awareness, for one, on mental health problems and a willingness to talk about those is really a good sign. And, you know, part of I think one of the questions underlying the rise of mental health problems is our youth simply more willing to talk about this, maybe than previous generations even. Social media, you know, we talked about the harms it can do. I think there's also a lot of potential there to do good in terms of helping youth feel connected with peers, connecting them with mental health services, and even being able to screen youth in a more automatic way, you know, giving pop-ups for crisis lines, for example, when they might post certain things. So I think there is promise there if we can do it right. I also think some of the increasing attempts at building in wellness practices and skills in the schools, I think can really do a lot of good. And these can be things like having peer support within the schools, doing or having meditation or mindfulness related classes, you know, building in exercise and nutrition and guidance about sleep. So I think there are a lot of things that we can do. I think, like Anna was saying, some of these need to be implemented at scale on a bigger level, and so may take action really from the state or federal government to really, really begin to move the needle.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests, Anna Moffitt, Executive Director of NAMI Dane County, and Dr. Ryan Herringa, Professor and Director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. If you or someone you know is in a crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255.